Hey everybody, welcome back to Human Reaction. I'm your host, David Rand, sitting solo, doing this one, just you and me, just a one-on-one conversation here, me and the viewer. Thank you so much for watching. Today we're talking about, well, I'm going to announce that we have peace in Ukraine. Yes, breaking news, peace in Ukraine is coming. We know it. You know why? Because we're going to war in Venezuela. You'll find out why. While you're back, thanks for watching again, and please comment, like, subscribe, and let's dive into it. So I'm going to go through some history, but obviously the news item from this week is we are deploying 5,000 Marines to Venezuela at order of the President of the United States. We're going to dive into his specific comments and everything else in a minute, but I wanted to go back and just, because there's such a problem in foreign policy of a time horizon bias where the actual relationship between nation states, you know, is longer than any individual life. And that dynamic kind of embeds itself in institutions and then plays out over longer periods of time. So you don't really capture much about a country and its relationship to other countries when you just look at the shorter time horizon as it's typically covered by the news. And I'm really interested in the history of American foreign policy. So here we are. We're going to dive into a little bit of this. I'm just going to do some highlights. There's a lot more here. I didn't boil it down, so I'm going to jump around a little bit. But I'm going to try to do a timeline order so that we're all following really well. So this started off from the beginning. Venezuela gets its independence in the 1830s to the 1890s. Right off the bat, under President I'm going to butcher all the names here, guys. I'm sorry. And I don't have anyone here to correct me on names. Sorry. I don't. Anyways, President Joaquin Crespo, involving a territorial dispute with Britain over a particular line, leading to U.S. intervention in the establishment of the Monroe Doctrine. So Venezuela is the place where we establish the Monroe Doctrine. Venezuela has this dispute with Britain, and then we step in and say, Britain, Western powers all over the world, this hemisphere, the Western hemisphere is ours. Stay out of our backyard. You're not allowed here. Now, this era from the 1890s to 1945, there's kind of like where the states of Venezuela are formulated, and they're kind of like small geographies, and they are united in 1945. But before that time, there's another dispute between Venezuela and the Western powers in 1902 to 1904. And this is where the Monroe Doctrine changes. It's really important because in order to understand U.S. foreign policy, the Monroe Doctrine is like the starting point for us being a regional power. It's where we say, hey, we're going to defend from colonial powers any investment or any attack on the West, on the Western Hemisphere. In 1902, that changes, and it becomes, we own this place, and here's why. So Roosevelt is in charge of the country at the time, and there's a Venezuelan crisis where there's a Britain, Germany, and Italy. They show up, and they do a naval blockade against Venezuela, and they're basically demanding Venezuela pay their debts due to a refusal for foreign debt payment. Theodore Roosevelt expands the Monroe Doctrine, and he asserts that the right of the U.S. to intervene in the not only in to keep Western powers out, but the right to intervene in the affairs of Latin America countries if they are unable to, quote, maintain order and stability. This corollary was used to justify U.S. interventions in countries like Cuba, Nicaragua, and Haiti later. And we'll dive into that kind of the big numbers on American foreign policy in South America in a minute, but it's an important to understand, like, this is the statement of philosophy of the approach that we take. And it's such a contrast to the founders, right? It's so far from Washington and Madison and the original, you know, way that we thought of ourselves as a nation, as a republic, as an experiment in maximizing liberty. And instead into we now control all of the countries of the Western Hemisphere. Now, it's important to put this in the context, too, of the Banana Wars and the Spanish-American War and everything leading into this early 1900s era as America trying to become like Europe for some reason. I don't understand why. It's never made sense to me. When you read the history, you see it all over the place, but it's there. And it's so frustrating that we would find ourselves evolving that way. But, of course, I wasn't alive at the time. But how cool would it have been if that never happened? How cool would it have been if America just stayed the republic, just stayed this experiment? And what if we just maximized freedom by minimizing government and created the rule of law, and we would evolve out of the worst institutions we had, like slavery and the bigotries of the past and, you know, traditional hierarchies that we imported from Europe. And instead, we just became the best that we could become rather than becoming an empire. What proof would that be of the thesis of the superiority of Western ideas and individualism and things like that that arose in the Enlightenment? But unfortunately, we lost that fight and the progressives won. Woodrow Wilson being one of them, but at this point in time, it would being Woodrow Wilson being like the encapsulator, the head of it, the biggest, like, metaphorical, visual, political, power-wise, everything of the progressive movement prior to FDR that really changed the direction of the country towards the managerial state. So in the 1920s, soon after this time, Standard Oil, you know, it significant oil reserves are found in Venezuela. It propels into one of Latin America's strongest economies, this leading to increased U.S. involvement, of course, because the people who build the oil is Standard Oil. Yes, that's Standard Oil, the one of Rockefeller fame, and it's now called ExxonMobil. So they're not gone anywhere. See here. There was a transition to democracy in 1945. Soon after that, in the 1950s, Standard Oil signs a new deal with Venezuela, saying we're going to split profits 50-50. 50 for the company, 50 for Venezuela. Now, this spreads to places like Saudi Arabia and other places, but not to one other country, Iran. And it's interesting that this oil revenue split, you know, it seems to have really worked in Venezuela's favor, that somehow they were able to negotiate that without being overthrown in a coup, unlike Iran. But they found themselves able to continue operating. But what they did is a couple years later, in 1989, they create the, I'm not going to butcher the name again, Petróleos de Venezuela S.A. So PDVSA. And that's pretty much an oil company owned by the government. It's not a nationalizing of the oil companies. Those will happen later. But this is just at that time, they create their own oil company. In 1992, Hugo Chavez comes on. At least he attempts a coup in 1992 against the president, who is seen as too pro-U.S., this leading into Chavez's imprisonment and then later rise to power. Hugo Chavez in 1999 becomes president. 2002, Chavez is briefly ousted in a coup, but is restored to power with the support of the loyal military ranks and popular mobilization. So the U.S. is accused of supporting this coup, although it denies direct involvement. You be the judge. 2007, the Venezuelan government expropriates assets of foreign U.S. oil companies. This would be ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips. And they declined to restructure the holdings to grant PDVSA. After they declined to not allow them, the state-owned oil company, to own them, they then just nationalized them, pretty much. This led into major challenges. So this is really the pivot point. Like, we are pissed off at Chavez, you know? But this is really where it takes the turn in 2007. Before then, it's really interesting because Chavez comes in as like this socialist, and he begins to, you know, take oil profits, and he starts, you know, using that to these mission programs to better the people, and it's celebrated in socialist and left wing circles. 2007, he says, "Well, we want to have control over your oil assets, American companies that developed all the oil assets," and you know. They say, "Nah, I'd rather not." And then they were like, "Well, we'll just nationalize the whole thing." And that gave them majority control. This is a PDVSA, the company owned by the government. So it's the government owned, right? So Nicolas Maduro succeeds Chavez, starting out in 2013 and by 2019. And then he faces, over this time, increasing U.S. pressure, sanctions. This is the U.S. Recognizes Juan Guaido as the legitimate president in Venezuela in 2019. This is a really interesting story. Hold on to that for an second. We're going to zoom back 1 second, because over the same time of escalating pressure in 2014 is when Tren de Agua was created, actually out of a prison. You know what's funny? If you look at Tren de Agua's creation, it's shockingly similar to ISIS. Yeah, they're like, these guys find each other in a prison camp, and then they're like, you know, let's do a thing. You know, the boys just get together and they just did a thing. And they just like, let's just create a gang, an international cartel. Wouldn't that be neat? Well, just imagine what you and your boys could really do if you put your minds to it. You too could be charged with an international gang. So So they become, they blow up from 2014, stay relatively small, but blow up by the end of 2019. Interesting, kind of that kind of patterns with Maduro and his fight with Juan Guaido. So in 2019, the diplomatic relationship between the United States and Venezuela ends. We both pull our diplomats out of each other's countries. And this happens around the Guaido story. So May of 2018, Nicolas Maduro wins re-election in a vote that's widely denounced as fraudulent by the U.S. and the EU and many Latin American countries. In January that year, January 5th, the opposition leader Juan Guaido becomes president of Venezuela's National Assembly, their legislative body. In the morning of the 23rd, Guaido declares himself the interim president of the Venezuela's National Assembly, saying it's not Maduro anymore, it's me. Guaido declares himself, the U.S. recognizes Guaido the same day. So they were quick on the ball. If this wasn't coordinated, you know, those machinery of government can somehow really move quick when it needs to. Then think of that the next time you're at the DMV. Maduro retaliates by the afternoon, announcing Venezuela is severing diplomatic ties with the U.S. and ordering U.S. diplomats out within 72 hours. It goes on, is more there's more drama there, but what it ends is effectively Maduro gets the backing of the military and nothing really changes. Some states recognize Guaido and then they just kind of trickle away after they realize they can't do anything about it. And Guaido's now is he's exiled. He got actually thrown out by his own party and then, you know, when basically the coup fails. It isn't a derogatory to say coup in this sense, because like everyone in this story has tried a coup at some point. So it's not exactly what it would mean in other contexts. And he ends up in exile. One last part of this when it comes to Trinidad, which I think is important because it does demonstrate at least some of the strength of the administration's argument, is this a story of 2024. Trinidad had killed last year a guy named Ronald Ojeda, a former Venezuelan army officer who had conspired against Nicolas Maduro and fled to Chile. Oda was abducted by gang members who were dressed in military, like police outfits, and killed, dressed and killed him. His body found chopped up the next morning. Crazy story, right? And that kind of shows like some professionalism. They suspect that the folks who did that might have been Trinidagua. So, to zoom back out again and just kind of see this overall pattern of oil and interest in socialism versus freedom and like this weird Cold War thing that started kicking up of like, oh my God, they're socialists. They're spending their profits on social programs in the early 2000s is a strange dynamic. But Venezuela definitely takes it too far. They go in and they start socializing everything. They end up socializing in the early 2000s under Maduro and those folks, six oil companies, the electricity sector completely. That means all the energy generation, energy transmission, everything else, telecommunications, media, banking, steel, mining, the entire gold sector, multiple other mines in other parts of the sector. So when you say mixed economies, these guys mean mixed, but if you like knocked the sugar into the bowl and like just went with it and you're like, you're making cupcakes, not bread anymore now. Food, agriculture, 50 major firms and farms of agriculture have been nationalized. One major retail grocery store and dozens of markets, two airlines, transportation, and ferry companies, and yeah, two hotels. Interesting, the two Hilton hotels and a Hyatt, and then hundreds of others. We're talking clinics, warehouses, factories, land holdings, residential, commercial properties, all between 2005 and 2012, and even some more recent ones like those grocery stores I said were even more recent. So they haven't stopped, kind of trying to slow walk themselves into real socialism, meaning the government ownership of the means of production. All right. So the dynamic with Trump. So coming back out of the overall history arc and sitting at 15 minutes, Trump is the U.S. administration's approach to Venezuela during the first Trump administration was more economic sanctions, diplomatic isolation, and military posturing, as is common for Trump. All out at, you know, this whole story with Guaido, that really happens during the Trump administration going into the early Biden administration when it fails. this shouldn't be surprised if this is regime change, as I indicated that it might be up front. I could be over my skis or not, but it wouldn't surprise us based upon the campaign trail.
Venezuela. How about we're buying oil from Venezuela? When I left, Venezuela was ready to collapse. We would have taken it over. We would have gotten all that oil. It would have been right next door. Venezuela.
Yeah, the oil. Interesting interesting thing to be concerned about when people are eating zoo animals. No, I get it, though. I get it. I mean, that's the reality of geopolitics and what people in positions of power can be. Awful shame. But it's an interesting dynamic. I mean, there's this relationship, you know, ultimately has had some positives that brought about the Trump administration when he took back over as of earlier this year. So Donald Trump was able to, from him tweeting here, I've just been informed that we are bringing 6 sausages home from Venezuela. Thank you, Rick Gardell and the entire staff. Great job. So I like this Trump better. I mean, it's brief. It's not as ranty. It's less capitals. And he's not thanking me for my attention. I still find that weird and endearing, but weird. So also remember earlier, it wasn't too long ago, you know, that we had this story, I mean, last year, of the gang cartel members taking over the Aurora apartment buildings. Remember that? These were Tren de Agua, and this is where Tren de Agua really blew up on the national scene. We had a former FBI guy actually coming in and talk on the podcast about it. You should look that up, that podcast episode. It was a great time. Interesting fella. Good times. But this blew up in national television. Now, the degree to which it might have been overblown, making it seem like half of Colorado had taken over by Venezuelan Chaz, was probably overreported by some folks on the right. But it wasn't nothing either, as the left seemed to claim. This is a substantial thing. In fact, it still has a debated community note about the size and scale of the operation. So what happened this week? Well, the Trump administration doubled their award leading to the arrest of Maduro. We have AG Pam Bondi with that. Now, I think, and when you listen to this, know the strangeness of her voice. Like the delivery here, like just you in the comments section, tell me how you feel about this delivery.
Justice and State Department are announcing a historic $50 million reward for information leading to the arrest of Nicolas Maduro. Maduro uses foreign terrorist organizations like TDA, Sinaloa, and Cartel of the Suns to bring deadly drugs and violence into our country. To date, the DEA has seized 30 tons of cocaine linked to Maduro and his associates with nearly 7 tons linked to Maduro himself, which represents a primary source of income for the deadly cartels based in Venezuela and Mexico. Cocaine is often laced with fentanyl, resulting in the loss and destruction of countless American lives. The DOJ has seized over $700 million of Maduro-linked assets, including 2 private jets, 9 vehicles, and more. Yet Maduro's reign of terror continues. He is one of the largest narco traffickers in the world and a threat to our national security. Therefore, we've doubled his reward to $50 million. Under President Trump's leadership, Maduro will not escape justice and he will be held accountable for his despicable crimes. If you have any information to bring this criminal to justice, call 1-202.
Yeah, guys, call if any of our viewers know where Maduro's at, give him a ring, you know, give him a, isn't that what we have the NSA for, right? I mean, is it just me? Or is it strange? It's strange, right? It's weird to issue a reward. Like there's someone in Venezuela being like, oh yeah, got it. I'll get $50 million. Especially if you're like a member of the military, right? Who would be the people who would actually know that, or the police or administrative member? Because that would mean, you know, that'd be, how do you get the reward? Do they send it to you in Bitcoin, you think? I don't know. Anyways, so So the Trump administration designated several cartels, including Mexico's Sinaloa cartel and Venezuela's Tren de Agua, as global terrorist organizations earlier this year, right? And then they issue this. And then now this is they're now sending out the USS Gravely, the USS Jason Dunham, the USS Sampson, along with 4,000 military personnel to the edge of Venezuela's territorial water. So right now, as far as we know, the mission is to hang out. So this kind of broader effort beyond the issuing of your tax dollars to find this guy, even though you already fund the NSA at $1,000 and the CIA or $1 trillion or billion, hundreds of billions of dollars, sorry, and the CIA and all these agencies. But it's really up to you on the tip line to help them find where Maduro's at so they can stop him. So this next bit is from the press office here in the, and during the press scrum or press meeting room, the White House meeting press room, talking about, you know, this operation.
Thanks, Caroline. I wanted to ask about the 3DS warships that are being sent to Venezuela, and there's 4,000 Marines on board. Are you looking at possibility of boots on the ground there?
What I will say with respect to Venezuela, President Trump has been very clear and consistent. He's prepared to use every element of American power to stop drugs from flooding into our country and to bring those responsible to justice. The Maduro regime is not the legitimate government of Venezuela. It is a narco-terror cartel. And Maduro, it is the view of this administration, is not a legitimate president. He is a fugitive head of this cartel who has been indicted in the United States for trafficking drugs into the country. And with that, I will leave you all, and we will see you later, if not tomorrow. And I look forward to taking more of your questions. Thank you.
So are we going to war with Tren de Agua, or are we going to war with Venezuela, the country, the nation state? Well, it's interesting, right? Because nation states and mobs and, you know, cartels have a relationship, a very interesting relationship. It actually, before we get into that, because I think when you understand our relationship with the mob via our intelligence service, I think it brings this accusation into fuller light. I have no one else to talk to here, so I don't know how to handle burps. I don't know what that's about, but stick with me, okay? All right, so in response to this, Maduro, the Venezuelan president, has announced the mobilization of 4.5 million militia troops throughout the country. Maduro's move seems to be a direct counter. Obviously, the timing doesn't make a lot of sense otherwise. And the leader is vowing to defend the country's sovereignty against what he perceives as outlandish threats from the U.S. What is the ask of the United States right now? And one thing I'm asking myself is how does parking a couple battleships outside of Venezuela really secure less drugs being imported to the United States? What's the plan there exactly? You know, when we talked about America First, I don't think this is what people had in mind when they said, we're going to go to war with the drug cartels. I don't think an invasion of Venezuela was in people's mind. And you know, what's interesting here is how many people I think are actually going to be captured by this, because they're using all the right buzzwords. They're using the buzzwords of, well, drugs are being imported and fentanyl deaths, and those are real concerns. I'm not diminishing that. But we are invading another country here, maybe, if that's what they're there for. If they were clearer about that, they're like, oh, well, why we're doing this is because they're shipping all of their stuff by secret boats or submarines, and we're going to get those submarines. That's more sensible. I don't think they have submarines, and I don't think the secret boats are there. I suspect a lot of this is being moved through Central America. And to the degree to which they're breaking the status quo to go after a real American problem, such as drug use and things like that, I'm sympathetic. At least the government is not spending my money in Ukraine. I'm sorry. In Israel. Sorry. In Egypt. Nope. Sorry. Sorry. Well, they are spending some money trying to do a thing for Americans, aka stop us from overdosing on drugs, which is sympathetic. That's like the soft bigotry of my low expectations speaking a little bit there. But This appears to me, when you combine it with the history and our anxiety around oil share profiting, and the history of both, you know, Operation Ajax in Iran, to this relationship with Maduro, which really, with the Venezuelan government, which really became tenuous when they nationalized one of our company's oil industries. Right. When they just had their own little oil company, it was like not a huge problem. When they just renegotiated profit sales at the time, the highest profit sale from a colonialist country of sorts. That's not really the right word for here, but it's kind of like a corporate cronyism or colonialism of sorts. I'm not trying to mean that in the left wing example. But anyways, when they renegotiated the highest rate in the world at the time, we didn't really have a problem with them. It was really when they nationalized Standard Oil. And that's where it gets to the question of, well, should they be allowed to do that? Well, I don't think they should. I think private property, if they signed a deal and a contract and that deal lasts forever, they should fulfill that contract. That said, what does sovereignty mean if you can't, right? At some point do that? And to what degree is it on the property owners of the private company to invest in another country and then suffer losses when that country's unreliable? If you invest in a country that doesn't have strong contract law or property rights or is likely to nationalize an industry, maybe you shouldn't lean on the federal government to make sure you keep your profits coming, you know? That's kind of on you. You were the one who took your private capital and invested in Venezuela, Standard Oil. So I'm not sure that I should pay for that, right? And you might be saying, well, I mean, Trump might be saying, and this is going to indicate on the campaign trail, but we're paying for it in higher oil prices. Well, that's the result of, you know, the everyone producing and consuming. That's like not any individual actor. Hayek had an interesting thing about this when you think about social justice, because that's a very social justice-y like argument, that I have a right to cheap oil. When I don't really, and no one really does, the cheap oil is a result of the buying and selling and protection of the government, of the buying and selling and development of the recipes that make the structure of production in the first place. That isn't a thing that the government exists to make sure I have. And the degree to which the empire is kind of built on that premise is really the crux of that. We have to, as conservatives and libertarians, people of the right who believe in the institutions of the West, have to actually anchor ourselves in our principles and actually point out that no, we don't. In fact, it isn't the ends do not justify the means, and we don't want to be an empire anymore. I think that's what America First really meant, at least in my eyes and in the eyes of many people who are supportive of the concept. So I don't think this was in the minds of going to war with cartels either, right? So when we say go to war with the cartels, what I had in mind was, you know, stopping the cartels in America, you know, stopping the border crossings, the illegal border crossings, which kudos. You can't give enough kudos for the president on that. That's a substantial win in his ledger. But if we end up spending, you know, billions of dollars on invading Venezuela, that would be a definite L in the column. So next up, this analog to Iran, as I was kind of exploring before, is interesting because we're still pissed at Iran, you know, and that's crazy. That's a long time, you know, from the late 70s all the way to today. And in this case, it's a shorter period of time. I'll grant them that. I mean, what we're looking at here is, when did they do that again? It was in 2007 that they expropriated the assets of those two private companies. You know, I think we should let it go. I think we can let a lot of things go. If we can let go, you know, Syria's president being a head chopper when he was a kid, a young man, you know, if we can let go, if we could tolerate a member of Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda in that area, he was more like a branch manager of Al-Qaeda, if you will, not like the head guy. But if we can tolerate him in Syria, I feel like we can maybe tolerate Venezuelans just, you know, buying and selling on the market and, you know, running their faces into the ground of socialism, if that's what they really want to do. It really feeds the leftist narrative here about the U.S. government being intolerant of leftism anywhere. Now, I don't think that's actually the cause. I think the underlying cause is actually trying to control oil markets more so than anything else. But it does give them some credence to that, you know, like, You can start to see the Groyper point of view when you see an Israeli, you know, national security guy come to our country and try to hook up with a 15-year-old and get caught and then flee the state, as we covered in the last episode. You go and then be like, wow, there's a really bad relationship, really toxic relationship we have with the Israeli government, if that was indeed a political decision by the administration, not just some crazy mistake, which would be a lot of convenience to tolerate. But you kind of see the left-wing point of view of we can't allow socialism to happen anywhere. Like, it's like the hanger-on of like communist, Cold War ways of thinking about the world. It's some kind of giant battle between communism and freedom that we have to everywhere around the world. We can't let anyone be a socialist. Even as we're totally friendly with incredibly socialist countries that have enormous welfare states all across Europe, I don't really see how the Venezuela of 2007 or 2006, right before this, was really that different than the Venezuelan afterwards in terms of their socialism, even though they did keep on running down that trail. I don't think that was the reason why we became pissed at them. We got the State Department, really, we in the sense of the government, that the government became, upset at them more so because of the oil. So this asks the question of the cause du jour of the war that we're about to do, potentially. I may be overselling it a bit. Forgive me. Is this relationship between Tren de Agua and the Venezuelan government. Maduro himself specifically. Although if you look at the architecture of this argument, it seems to trace all the way back to Hugo Chavez, but more so Maduro. So there was a leak in the intelligence community in April of this year, drawing stories that suggested that TDA was not acting at the direction of the Venezuelan government. Now, Tulsi and Patel says that their assessment says the exact opposite. And this is from Just News. They put this bad boy out. So Tren de Agua, in league with Maduro, Gabbard and Patel say, after illegal classified leaks. So someone leaked out of the intelligence community this thing that had redacted parts to the report that suggested that that there was no connection. But in fact, the full intelligence brief said there was. This isn't like the Iran thing at all. It doesn't play the same. The story is very different when it comes to the supposed intelligence thing, which is still not well accounted for. And I hope Tulsi will account for someday. But this one seems to indicate that is indeed the finding of the intelligence community. And I have a richer brief on that as well, because there's more to the story. So the pro collaborator argument goes in a couple of things. So you got that 2024 story about the guy, the former Venezuelan officer who was conspiring against Maduro. He flees to Chile. People show up in police uniforms, take him, abduct him, really, and is killed. Multiple witnesses testified that Ojeda, the guy who was under suspicion of conspiring against Maduro, was ordered at that assassination of him was ordered at the highest levels of the Venezuelan government. One protected witness identified Diosdado Cabello, Venezuela's powerful interior minister and Maduro's right hand man, as the official who instructed Tren de Agua's leader to carry out the killing. This is from the Human Rights Foundation. Not exactly the kind of organization that is usually more center left. So they're not exactly the kind that is going to be highly provoking of a conflict between the two countries. But that is also based upon relatively unsourced, in sense of like we don't know who exactly is these witnesses, and the reporting as I tried to track down, it kind of ends in a trust me bro. So another piece of evidence I did think was interesting, from the Human Rights Foundation, is Tren de Agua maintained control over what they call peace zones, like San Vicente neighborhood in Aragua state. This is the kind of sub-province of Venezuela where Tren de Agua was formed out of, where the Venezuelan government ceded territorial authority and provided resources through foundations, according to allowing Trinde Agua to manage local security and order, which means they had like a sub-jurisdiction directly from the government paid to them through private foundations, which indirectly benefited the regime, obviously reducing operational costs. So it's like a libertarian whip dream, if you will. Like, they privatized security by giving it over to the mob. Now, just imagine if in the 1930s or maybe 50s, let's say 50s, and they were like, let's do it during Prohibition. If the government was like, we give up on this whole thing, you just have Chicago, mob. You know, I mean, that's kind of what's going on here. They're paying them to stabilize things on their behalf. Interesting moment in the argument that the relationship with TDA is substantial. The FBI has assessed that some Venezuelan government officials facilitate the migration of Trinde Agua to members of members to the United States to advance the Maduro's regime effective. That's from official FBI releases. An unnamed former Venezuelan military officer discussed that the threat of Trinde Agua on Fox News in 2024. Quote, "They create chaos in Chile. They create chaos in Peru. And they want to create also chaos in countries in order to shape the content of the borders." So the argument from, and that's from Heritage. So a little bit more hawkish, so keep that in mind. But the argument from both Human Rights Foundation and Heritage is that at some point the Maduro regime kind of co-opted Trinde Agua and against pro-democracy protesters in Venezuela to kind of maintain his power, attacking demonstrators, eliminating opponents while operating with official impunity, indirectly benefiting the government, outsourcing their repression functionally, right? Now, this does feel very familiar. This feels like the Italian campaign. So right after World War II, right before the CIA is really created, right in the beginning of the CIA's creation, they find out that there's an election going on that they need to interfere with in Italy, because you got a communist versus a person supportive of Western capitalism. You got someone who might be allied with the Soviets versus someone who would be allied to us, meaning the corporate us. The CIA says, well, we got to pull together all of our old, we got to pull the gang back together. All the people that helped us out in taking out Italy in World War II, Mussolini, we got to get those guys back together. We got to get the church and the Italian mob and all these other things. And we're going to get together. We're going to win this election for our guy. We can't allow democracy to happen. So, because it's too risky, right? Can't just do an upright campaign. Can't do it based upon actual democratic principles. These defenders of Western values had to make sure democracy doesn't happen. So they go in and they overthrow that election. This effort by the Maduro regime feels very similar to that. And I think that in light of our intelligence community's relationship with these things in our country and globally, working through cartels, remember, for example, here's another one, especially on the international bit, because that's interesting, but that's a long time ago. Do you remember Edward Snowden? Do you remember his interview with Glenn Greenwald? And he's basically like, yeah, I'm going to be getting on an airplane here soon. I got to get out of here because the CIA is definitely hiring the triads to kill me. Because he did the meeting in Southeast Asia where there are Asian mobs who the CIA has relationship with that he's familiar with and declaring this. That suggests that these kind of assassinations or other operations being done through coordinated and systematic relationships with mob and, you know, with cartels is real and continues to this day. The con side of that, they are not collaborators, is there is a declassified menu from the National Security Council states that the intelligence community does not believe that Maduro is that. That was from WAPO. So that might be the one that the Just Case News, what's this called again? Just the News is talking about. So obviously I don't want to just go with any source as authoritative. But something smells right about this in terms of, is there likely a relationship? Yes. To what degree is Maduro the head of it, as the White House is now claiming? I'm skeptical, guys. I'm not sure that he's the head of it. I'm sure it's more like our relationship with the mob, where I wouldn't formulate it as the CIA controls the triads. I would suggest that the CIA sometimes works when there's alignment and they have money and they want money. I think that's probably more likely in this case as well. So the domestic politics of this is interesting, right? So Marco Rubio, right? This cat, you know, from Florida, part Cuban. The Cuban exile thing is real. You know, I remember having a conversation with some Cuban folks at an event one time. And at the time, Obama was considering lifting sanctions on Cuba. And I was like, well, obviously the sanctions aren't working. And obviously they're no longer a threat with nukes. There is no Soviet Union backing them. Why wouldn't we release those sanctions and then, you know, see if we can get them with honey rather than the stick? Because the stick's not working. You know, I mean, it's been a long time since the Cuban Revolution, guys. Maybe not. Maybe that's not working. So let's try something else. And these guys were like, no, you don't understand. No peace forever. And what's interesting is what we're talking about here is their relatives. These are their great uncles and second cousins and, you know, their families left and they're in America now, but these folks are still their relations and this is still their homeland of sorts, right? And they really have no concern about that. They're more interested ideologically in just punishing the regime, even as the regime continues for decade after decade. I'm not really sure what we think we're accomplishing here. But Marco Rubio comes up in this milieu and has long been an assertive voice on confrontation with Cuba and confrontation against Venezuela and other left-wing governments across Central Asia or South America, Central Asia. So this Cuban variable and the Marco Rubio variable, and I do wonder, and I saw some speculation about this online, and I do think it's worthy posing is, you know, think with Witkoff and Trump doing Ukraine and Israel, you think Marco Rubio is just sitting there, who's the lead diplomat, not getting to do any diplomacy, thinking, well, you know, I got to wet my beak a little bit, you know, and I got to make sure we get this thing in there. And that's really where my theory of this is an intervention comes from. I've thought for a minute that, you know, the best way to create peace in Ukraine is to start a new war someplace. And for a second, I thought Iran might be that. You know, Iran might be the place that we start a new war. So then the military industrial complex can be like, oh, well, no problem. We'll just spend our money over here now. And their profit making machine called death and destruction can, you know, redirect itself into a new money making venture. A new market opportunity, if you will, for the people at Northrop Grumman and all those places. And maybe this is it. Maybe Marco was like, you know, you really want peace in Ukraine, President Trump. I really want to start a war in Venezuela. Why don't we do this? And we'll get the oil afterwards. And Trump being like, you got it, Marco. I could see that being the end game here. Maybe I'm being pessimistic. That's a good criticism. Maybe I'm being overly pessimistic that's how it works. But I'll take the bet. Let's do it. Let's bet right here. So the other internal debate that I do think is interesting here, that's worthy of debate, is the international socialism versus freedom debate is why are they poor? Now, if you look at Venezuela's freedom index and their per capita, there's, you know, and this doesn't surprise, won't surprise anyone in my audience, right? Is that, you know, you got Malaysia, Poland, and Venezuela, and kind of how they progress through time. And you see Venezuela, they're just creeping way down, right? As Malaysia and Poland, who all start out at similar places from 1990 to 2022. It doesn't look good. You know, you're seeing that GDP per capita creep down just as their other metric. What am I missing here? This is too small for me to read. I'm getting old, man. Per capita by the economic freedom scale from the human progress people. I mean, and that's, you know, that's real. That's maybe not only sanctions in the sense that you know, it is true that Venezuela pivots and, you know, through the Hugo Chavez regime, all of this, you know, the 50% oil profit share into all these social programs. And then when those are taken away by the administration, you know, by sanctions and things like that, that they now no longer have that money. And the money that there was never, it didn't build up organically. So taking that away, you can understandably see a decline from that. But also it doesn't help when you're collectivizing the agriculture for producing food. When you collectivize these other things, it shortages typically do arise. And one of the reasons why that happens is the thing that we call the knowledge problem, which is that government bureaucracies do not know the contextual information of things on the ground that actually lead to productivity in the deployment of the recipes of the economy, meaning the things that chain things together to make things. So those recipes are embedded knowledge that and principled knowledge that can't just be applied everywhere equally. They have to be applied contextually on the ground. And that's why private property ownership is so critical. So Venezuela, as it leaned into the leftism, not just the welfareism, but in the leftism, and found themselves in a situation where, despite being a very rich country, still selling oil to other places on the planet, limited in their scope and paying a heavy price for this nationalization thing. I suspect, I really do suspect that if they had never done that, that they would still be a country like many other countries and just with a big welfare state and not facing these enormous sanctions. Now, that isn't an argument for the sanctions. That's an argument, you know, for, you know, freedom and capitalism and the institutions that create human progress and prosperity. If you're going to fight with the number one largest country in the world, the super mega awesome power that is the great empire of America, you better have really good, strong institutions. See, as a counterexample, Russia and China, who have built up large institutions domestically to be able to withstand sanction pressure and tariffs and stuff like that. So is this gamesmanship or is this a potential escalation? Now, this could be just much like Iran as what actually happened with Iran. So my fears did not come to be true. I was not a trustican and I am still not a trustican. I have a hard time. Anyone who asked me to just trust the government, you know, I came up out in the Bush era and the Obama era. So I am intrinsically untrusting of the government. And maybe that's a fault. You know, maybe it is a fault. I'm open to that. But I just can't. So, but maybe I should. And the trust argument here is something like, well, we're going to park these, all these troops and all these folks right off the shores of Venezuela. And then we're going to say, give us back our oil companies. And then if they do, then all of a sudden we'll lift the sanctions and everything else. Maybe is that the ask? I wish the administration would just be clear about the ask. You know, what are they going to say? Are they going to say stop shipping drugs? And I do wonder, like, and this is the most uncomfortable question of the group, is the increasing amount of drug trade and migration, immigration from Venezuela to all across South America and into North America, an unintended consequence of the sanctions regime? They do kind of work in parallel in the sense of as they socialize and as we crack down on sanctions, there's more migration and there's more drug trade. Trinidad Agua is really the beneficiary in the sense of a middleman to continue to bring money into Venezuela in the black market since all of the white market has been closed out. Basic economic theory would suggest that if you make something illegal, you're now forcing that good into the black market rather than into the market where regular order applies. Things like courts and contract law and things like that that the government can, you know, signs off on and protects, right? They protect that. So when you take that away with a sanctions regime or a drug war or anything else, you force more of that into the black market. And perhaps we've created this problem. And this is trying to solve this problem without solving the underlying problem, which is that you suspect that many of the people who are now involved in Tren de Agua are involved because there's no other option, because there's no economic activity, because there's no trade coming out of Venezuela. I think that's a reasonable argument, but I would love to know where I'm wrong. Please jump in the comments and let me know. But noting that 7 to 8 million migrants have fled Venezuela into neighboring countries, and many of them winding up back in the United States. So I do want to note, too, lastly, the fiscal costs and the expenses of South America and our control over South America since the expanded Monroe Doctrine. So, and I didn't, I'm not a professional podcaster, guys. So I couldn't find a singular place that totaled all this up. So I just did it with AI. So if there's a little inaccuracy here, I think it's directionally right and is in a safe bet. But the cost of this operation, if they just hang out there for a month, is between $250 and $300 million. Chunk of change. Not a small thing. And if you look at our rough calculation I pulled together, the past operations of South America that we've done in the years of conflict of occupation, trying to total those up. Out of 100 years history that I pulled from, we have been funding cumulatively, and some of these would be double counted, like we're in Guatemala and we do something in another country at the same time. It'd be two, when it might be only a year long. But 53 out of 100 years, 53 to 54 years out of 100, have we had some operation going on in South America. Of that, you know, for U.S. casualties killed in these operations, we're looking at approximately 5,000 casualties, meaning 3,300 killed and around 1,700 wounded. South American casualties is around 46,000 dead. And that is not including the collateral consequences, such as very long-term war or civil war after an intervention. Things like Guatemala, things like El Salvador, places like that where there are trailing off costs to interventions. And then lastly, the cost of the U.S. taxpayer is $15 billion in 2023 dollars. Non-trivial. We could do a lot if we were about $15 billion wealthier, I would suggest. I know what you're saying. That's a drop in the bucket compared to U.S. productivity. But, you know, I'm just greedy like that. I just kind of want all the money to stay in America as much as we can. That's just a failing of mine. So some of the things here is like everything from the Spanish-American War in Cuba in 1898 to the occupation of Haiti in 1915 and 1934, the occupation of Nicaragua, 1912, 1933, the CIA coup in Guatemala, the Dominican Republic intervention, the coup in Brazil that we sponsored, the coup in Chile, support for the Argentina coup in 1976, Operation Urgent Fury in Grenada, Operation Just Cause in Panama, and then the Venezuelan coup attempt in 2002, and many others that I was able to pull together for the sake of getting a grasp on the big numbers there. And ultimately, like this whole thing of it appears to me to be generating a just cause for regime change war. Yes, that Maduro is really the head of Trinidadagua, not that the cartel doesn't have their own interest and things like that. But I do wonder, like, if that's what we're staring down the barrel of a real new conflict in South America. And I worry that what we're looking at is a new conflict on the same scale and order of Iraq and other places. And maybe that's just Iraq war syndrome, you know, paying too much of a great cost individually and collectively as a nation that we have a syndrome like the Vietnam syndrome. But I think it's a worthwhile debate to actually know what the actual goal is for these things, and suspiciously missing from the administration communication so far from what I've been able to find. So I'm hoping it doesn't happen. I'm hoping that we can get peace in Ukraine, peace in Israel without starting a new war. That would be neat. A little peace dividend of being the global hegemon, maybe. But I don't think that's likely. I think maybe we'll get those, like, what do we get between Afghanistan and the start of Ukraine? A couple years, maybe just a couple years, maybe a little nibble at the defense budget. Like, maybe we don't need to increase it to $1 trillion. Something like that would be nice. But if you got thoughts about this, so you could tell me where I'm wrong, obviously drop into the comments below. Make sure to like. And if you if this is your third video from us and you're a Groiper, this is what we do, although usually with more people in the room, you know, go ahead and subscribe. You've seen three videos from us. And if you got this far, you might as well, right? And if you want to get in our Discord, there are other Groipers in our Discord now telling us all about their philosophy of life. Really appreciate you guys watching, especially this far, sitting at 55 minutes. We did it together, you and me, having this great conversation. Thanks so much for watching. We'll catch you guys next time. Oh, one more thing. We're going to be switching it up. It does look like, I mean, look at the room. it does look like we we need to change something with the podcast. So we're working on some changes to make sure that we bring great content regularly that isn't as sporadic as it has been. So we're reformulating a few things. More announcements to come. But I think we're going to be moving to just once a week for us and once a week for the SCIF members here soon. So keep an eye out for those changes, and we'll be announcing them on the Discord and online as they come up. So once again, thank you so much for watching. Have a great week. Peace.
Thanks for tuning in to Human Reaction. Please be sure to like, follow, subscribe, and give us a review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you want to become a member and support the show financially, check out humanreactionpod.com.